Welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. We've mapped nations and planets, but only one-fifth of the seabed has been mapped in high resolution. It's hard to map a dynamic, changing entity like the ocean, but it's crucial. Doing so will help us track fish movements and maintain telecommunication cables. But more than that, according to Esri Chief Scientist Don Wright, healthy oceans keep our world alive.
The ocean is also where most of the living things on the planet are. So if you think about all of the things that live on this planet, including us, 50 to 80% of all of the life on Earth actually lives in and on the ocean.
Don Wright explains to Esri's Karen Sullivan why mapping the world's ocean is key to keeping it healthy.
Dawn, welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast.
Well, thank you, Karen. It's been a while since I've been on the podcast, so it's very nice to be back.
Well, we're really happy to have you here today to talk with us. Dawn, you grew up in Hawaii and you experienced its stunning natural landscape as a child. How did that place spark your fascination with the ocean and with earth science?
It's pretty impossible not to be aware of the ocean and to fall in love with the ocean living in Hawaii. Certainly for people who visit Hawaii, they get the same vibe. But for me, it really was a matter of falling in love with the ocean and seeing it as a sacred place, which is also part of the Polynesian culture. And growing up in Hawaii, you learn a lot about Polynesian history and culture. And so I really took that to heart and really absorbed that. And I think for just about anyone on the planet, it is a matter of falling in love with the planet, including the ocean, because then we are going to be really motivated to protect what we love and to find out as much as we can about it and to use it properly.
How are the ocean and our survival linked?
Oh, well, the ocean and our survival are inextricably linked together. For instance, over geological timescales, the ocean has provided a large fraction of the oxygen that we take in today. Around 50% of the primary production on Earth, which sustains our food system, but which also releases oxygen for us to breathe. The ocean is also where most of the living things on the planet are. So if you think about the biosphere, all of the things that live on this planet, including us, but 50 to 80% of all of the life on Earth actually lives in and on the ocean. So when we think about carbon dioxide emissions, for instance, which are right at the core of what is causing the problem of climate change, it's all of the human-caused carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. The ocean is absorbing quite a bit of that. About 25 to 30% of all of our carbon dioxide emissions, as well as around 90% of the additional heat that is generated by those emissions, the ocean is absorbing that. It's giving us a huge buffer against the harmful impact. So that is certainly another inextricable link. That's really, the ocean is buying time for us, which I often like to say is a real service that it provides for us. How the heating up of the oceans is causing our storms to become more severe. The ocean is more acidic, the damage to marine ecosystems. It's affecting the protein that we're able to get from the ocean. But in terms of how we're linked, the damage to coral reefs and other marine ecosystems, the drop in oxygen in the ocean is another huge concern. The lack of our knowledge of the ocean is still a huge concern. And so that's why we are mapping the deep and have so many programs, including a United Nations Ocean Decade program, to try to map 100% of the seabed, the ocean floor, by the year 2030, or at least a reasonable period of time beyond 2030.
In your book, Mapping the Deep, you describe yourself as an early adopter of geospatial technology for ocean research. You said it gives us a visual way to better understand complex problems. How did this technology first draw you in, and how has it continued to do so?
One of the wonderful things that happened to me in the early 90s is that I was in school working on my PhD, and when you work on a PhD, you have to do more than just come up with a project that you can do to answer a research question. You have to answer a research question that is among the hardest and most challenging, and one that will really advance the science in a big way. That's the higher stakes that doctoral students are faced with when getting a PhD, as opposed to other degrees. And it turned out in the 1990s, one of the big questions was, how can you more effectively map a part of the planet that is constantly in motion, that is dynamic, that is largely unexplored? And given the technology that we had at that time to learn more about the geology of the ocean, as well as its chemistry and physics and biology, of course, there still wasn't a way to integrate all of those different types of observations of the ocean into an integrated story to help us really understand processes. And I was fortunate enough to be working with people at UC Santa Barbara who were looking at one particular setting, which is the hydrothermal vents of the world, especially the hydrothermal vents of the East Pacific Rise. And these are the places that became famous when they were discovered in 1977 and were promoted relentlessly to wonderful effect by National Geographic. So thanks to National Geographic, so many people know what hydrothermal vents are, these places in the world ocean that are underwater. They're like underwater hot springs. They're places of wildly creative biology and chemistry. They're also places where there might be a hope there in terms of biopharmaceuticals in these strange creatures that live in these places, as well as a potential for geothermal energy. And they're just absolutely beautiful places to look at. They're always active and dynamic because they're places where the seafloor is literally being ripped apart. And because it's such an exciting place and a beautiful place, ocean science has been focused on it since its discovery in 1977. But there's so many different types of observations that you have to make at a place like this to really understand the totality of what's happening there and why it's happening. You're attracted to the chemistry of the place because of the minerals that are deposited there as hot hydrothermal fluid comes out of the seafloor and then hits the cold ocean water. So this is one of the places on the planet where you need to understand geology, chemistry, biology, physics. What I'm taking a very long time to say is that this is a place that needs integration, integration of data sets, which is what GIS was invented for, to help us to be able to integrate and interpret different types of data. My PhD dissertation was focused on that. It was very, very unusual at that time. It's now very commonplace what we can do with GIS in the ocean, but that really got me started on the road to not only understanding this part of the ocean that I was studying better, but also the technology to make GIS a better tool. I was able to participate in discussions with Esri in terms of how to move Esri's specific technology forward. A lot of those early ideas came in part from discussions with our ocean community to help us understand the ocean better. We tend to think about X and Y, or latitude and longitude. And as time has gone on, we've thought about X, Y, and Z, or in the ocean, it's X, Y, and Z, depth rather than elevation. But really, the multi-dimensional nature of GIS that we've been able to reach now is X, Y, Z, and T. So in the ocean, that is your latitude, longitude, depth, and time. In fact, in the ocean, it's always been a critical factor. We are not able to make measurements in the ocean unless we do have a time that's associated with it, because then we backtrack, so to speak, from that time to get a position and an observation. So time has always been a critical part of mapping the deep, and it will continue to be so.
You mentioned earlier that 70% of the Earth's surface is ocean. Why so little attention there?
On land, we only have to deal with air, and we could use light as a sensing device, and we can see everything on land by using photographs, videos that are taken from airplanes and from satellites, certainly. But these same vehicles, or these same modes of purveying sensors across the land, do not work in the ocean because they cannot see through the water. So that part of the electromagnetic scale that we are so comfortable with, and that we visually can see, that does not work in the ocean. Everything gets muddled and out of focus and scattered. We just cannot use light energy to see through the ocean water, especially to get to the bottom of things, to get to the seabed, and to make an equivalent accurate map of the water on this planet. We need to use a different type of energy. In the ocean, we have to be like the whales and dolphins and other marine mammals that use sound. Sound is the form of energy that works the best in water, in the ocean. That is the best way to get returns, responses from the ocean, and also to image in the ocean. We don't have a sensor on a satellite that can do that yet. There's no multi-beam sonar satellite that has been invented yet. So we have to be on or in the ocean for the most part in order to get the equivalent accuracy of maps for, let's say, for the seabed. We need to send out pulses of acoustic energy all the way down to the seafloor, have those pulses reflect back to the instrument, turn that travel time. So their time is very critical. Again, the time that it takes for the pulse to leave the instrument, go down to the seafloor, come back to the instrument, that travel time is turned into a depth. And that's basically how we get our underwater elevations or bathymetry. And that takes much more time. It's a slower process. So that's why we are so far behind in terms of having the equivalency in the resolution and the accuracy of the ocean floor to what we have on land.
Well, that's interesting. Does that mean that the same technology that we can use to create maps using imagery as the foundation, we can use sound with that same technology then?
So it's same but different. People are looking at and analyzing aerial photographs in ArcGIS. We have the equivalent in the ocean. They're called acoustic images, and they look like aerial photographs, but they are of the ocean floor, and they give us information such as the texture of the seafloor, whether places are covered with sediment or whether they are covered with bare rock. So this is how we can discover shipwrecks, for instance. If there's a shipwreck or a plane wreck or any type of underwater infrastructure, anything man-made that's in the ocean will be shown up in these acoustic images. So there are many, many examples. We map the ocean, especially the ocean floor, for, let's say, energy, offshore energy infrastructure siting. GIS, one of the most important, amazing things that GIS does is site suitability. Where are the best places to put things? So we can do this in GIS for offshore wind energy turbine siting, or for tidal energy structures, or for wave energy buoys. We know now that over 1.3 million kilometers of cables traverse the ocean floor. And these are called submarine cables. These submarine cables account for about 95% of all of our intercontinental data traffic. So that includes our phone calls, our streaming videos, our podcasts, radio shows. And we absolutely need to map the deep in order to maintain where all of these cables are. We have to know where they are in order to maintain them, but where they're going to be more that will need to be laying on the seafloor. We map the deep so that we know about shipping. Accurate seafloor maps give us the information that we need to keep thousands of ships safely moving goods around the planet. We use maps of the ocean floor as well as maps of sea surface wave height so that we can understand what will happen in the wake of a tsunami coming on shore, or another big storm such as a hurricane coming on shore. Where are those waves going to wash up? What infrastructure, what neighborhoods, what places along the coast are going to be in danger, and where should we evacuate people to accordingly? We use these maps to plan for new marine parks, marine reserves, marine protected areas. These are the equivalents of our state and national parks offshore. We map for fisheries management. We could do the whole podcast in terms of why this is all important.
What are the most intriguing mysteries about the ocean for you after you've spent so much time learning about it?
So one of the big mysteries of the ocean, because we have seen and mapped so little of it, is what is it like in the deepest place of the ocean? What can we learn from it? And so this is why the Mapping the Deep book was written, because it tells the story of my journey to Challenger Deep with one of our partners, one of our ArcGIS users, the Caledon Oceanic, which is an ocean science and discovery organization that's owned by Victor Vescovo, who's one of the most prolific explorers of the planet, because he's been to Mount Everest. He's been across both the North and the South Poles. He's been into space. But one of the things that he noticed was that in terms of our understanding of planet Earth, we had no idea where the deepest places in the world were. And even the ocean science community did not have accurate depths or accurate maps of these deepest places. So he undertook what's called the Five Deeps Expedition to definitively dive to and map the five deepest places on planet Earth, the deepest place in the Atlantic, the Arctic Ocean, the Southern Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Ocean has the deepest place, which is Challenger Deep, which is nearly 7 miles deep within the Mariana Trench. That's been one of the most enduring mysteries, these deep places. So it was really, as the book title says, the dive of a lifetime for me to accompany Victor to Challenger Deep. And we were also able to test the world's first side-scan sonar mapping device capable of withstanding the crushing pressures at Challenger Deep to do some remote sensing and to come back with some acoustic images of this deep place, as well as broader, more regional mapping of the entire Mariana Trench that we were able to do from the ship that put our submersible in the water. So that was really an amazing experience.
Do you see it more as kind of a science book, or do you think it's more personal experience, or both?
It's actually both. And people had so many questions about the dive, what it was like. They wanted to know about the submersible that took us there, because it's a unique submersible, one of a kind. It's the only one that can go as deep to Challenger Deep, to the deepest places on the ocean floor, and come back repeatedly. So it was actually something that Esri Press wanted to do. Esri Press came to me with the idea of writing the book, or doing the book together collaboratively, because of all of the interest in the dive itself, people's curiosity, and people's, I think, curiosity with my background and my story. The dive was a scientific dive, and the expedition was a scientific expedition. And talking about the dive also is a wonderful opportunity to talk about science, and which we've already covered so nicely in our conversation, in terms of why mapping the deep is so important.
What might readers be surprised to learn about once they get a chance to read the book?
I think what they'll learn is that as deep as we went, nearly 7 miles, under 16,000 pounds per square inch pressure, the kind of pressure that would, people are now familiar with the Titan submersible tragedy, and they were only at around 4,000 meters, and we went to 10,919 meters. In that pressure-filled, dark, cold place, there are beautiful creatures there in Challenger Deep, and it's part of the life of this planet. Another surprise is the extent of trash that can reach even the deepest part of the ocean, which is what we were surprised by, a beer bottle that we saw almost immediately upon reaching the bottom. That's not a secret. I mean, we tweeted about that from the ship when this dive took place, and that tweet went viral. So there are thousands, maybe millions of people now who know about the beer bottle we discovered on the ocean floor that reached Challenger Deep ahead of us. But the book gives you all of the contextual details.
Well, Dawn, there's so much to talk about in terms of your work and in terms of the dive to the deepest part of the ocean. Thank you so much for being here today. I really enjoy talking with you, and I find your work so inspiring. It's always good to have a chance to have a conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Air podcast. And thanks to Dawn Wright. Her book, Mapping the Deep, Innovation, Exploration, and the Dive of a Lifetime, takes the reader on an adventure to the bottom of the ocean. The audio version of Mapping the Deep is now available. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.